Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the San Angelo Standard Times for the week of Sunday, September 25th, 2022. We'll begin with a few local articles, followed by state articles, local sports, and then finally the column by Allison Watkins. Chipotle Mexican Grill opens first location in San Angelo by Rosanna Frere, published September 28th. Chipotle Mexican Grill opened its first location in San Angelo on Tuesday, September 27th. The restaurant at 3515 South Jackson Street has a dining room, front line, and a Chipotle drive-through pickup lane for guests to pick up digital orders without leaving their cars, according to Sally Evans, analyst and external communications for Chipotle. Chipotle is participating in the Downtown San Angelo Incorporated Sheeptacular Art Project and will display a Chipotle-themed sheep statue. The restaurant will be open daily from 10:45 a.m. to 10 p.m. We are planning to also open a second restaurant with the Chipotle at 5590 Sherwood Way this winter, Evan said. Tressie Lieberman, Vice President of Digital Marketing and Off-Premise, said they have created the Chipotle for customers to have a convenient experience when ordering. As a San Angelo native, I am thrilled that my community will now have access to Chipotle's real ingredients with two new Chipotle restaurants, Lieberman said. We've created a seamless and convenient experience for our guests, whether they choose to dine in the restaurant or order digitally for delivery or pickup via the Chipotle or mobile order pickup. Autumn has arrived, but when will it be time for clocks to fall back? By Hogan Gore, Austin American Statesman, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 23rd. With the first day of fall landing Thursday, on an unseasonably hot day, the question remains, when will we turn clocks back an hour for the sunset of daylight saving time? Ending annually on the first Sunday in November, daylight saving time will stop this year on November 6th, when the clock strikes 2 a.m. The time will revert to 1 a.m. While the human-instituted time change has zero impact on when the sun rises and sets, the additional hour is meant to help people better use natural light earlier in the day after originating as a way to help conserve energy during daylight hours. Daylight saving, not savings, time begins the second Sunday in March when clocks spring forward an hour. Credited with the first, albeit satirical, mention of a daylight conserving time system, Benjamin Franklin's An Economical Project in 1784 reasoned that people should wake with the sun to conserve candles. Every morning, as soon as the sun rises, let all bells in every church be set ringing. And if that is not sufficient, let cannon be fired in every street to wake the sluggards effectually, Franklin wrote. For people who could not see the light of the idea, Franklin reasoned that those who rise at 4 a.m. would have no issue being back in bed at a reasonable time of 8 p.m. It was not until the early 1900s that advocacy for a daylight saving system began to gain traction. Shortly after the onset of World War I, Germany, followed by Great Britain, began light-saving measures for an additional hour of daylight and in an attempt to save fuel and heating costs on their home fronts. In 1918, the United States was still new to the war and eager to be on the same timetable as her allies and foes, eventually leading Congress to approve the first daylight saving time change on March 31, 1918 at 2 a.m. Uncle Sam, your enemies have been up and are at work in the extra hour of daylight. When will you wake up? Propaganda posters across the country said. Now, however, not every state in the union participates in the annual time change, as both Hawaii and Arizona opted out based on a fairly consistent relationship with the sunshine on the islands and the heat in the desert. Additionally, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, the Northern Mariana Islands, Guam, and American Samoa do not practice daylight saving time. Over the past 5 years, 19 states, not including Texas, have passed legislation or resolutions seeking to make daylight saving time the standard time in their states. However, those legislative goals are contingent on changes at the federal level, which may come sooner rather than later. Passed unanimously by the U.S. Senate in March, a bill by Senator Marco Rubio, Republican Florida, would cancel daylight saving time and the hour switch on November 5th, 2023, instead of shifting back an hour at 2 a.m., as the country has for a century. The moment would pass and lead to 2:01 a.m. with no further adjustments in the future. The good news is that we can get this passed. We don't have to keep doing this stupidity anymore. Why would we be enshrined that? Why would we enshrine this in our laws and keep it for so long is beyond me, Rubio said upon the bill's passage in the Senate. The House has not yet taken up the measure. So for now, don't forget to turn your clock back an hour come 2 a.m. November 6th. San Angelo Standard Times opinion page. Letter to the editor. San Angelo polio survivors share memories after new reports of virus, by Dwayne Helwig and Robert Janik, published August 23rd. Because of recent news reports regarding the potential return of the polio virus, some due to recent generations' failure to have been vaccinated against the disease, we two local survivors want to share our polio experiences from our nationwide epidemic that occurred in 1952. There were events and circumstances we had in common during our personal lives endured after infection by the virus. Common polio events. 1. Our polio occurred during the summer of 1952. Dwayne, barely age 6, Robert, barely age 11. 2. We both became ill after visiting individual relatives the night before. 3. Both were under the care of local pediatrician Dr. R. M. Finks. 4. We both were hospitalized in the basement of the old clinic hospital here. 5. Each endured a painful memory. Dwayne got a spinal tap, Robert a tracheotomy while awake. 6. Both of our older siblings received a gamma globulin shot thought to prevent polio. 7. Dwayne's had paralytic type, lost an arm use. Robert's bulbar type, symptoms from neck up. 8. Robert almost died as bulbar affects breathing. Doctors weren't sure Dwayne could walk. 9. Both of us hated Sister Elizabeth Kinney, Australian nurse, hot pack treatments daily. 10. Dwayne enjoyed comic books. Robert, toy train catalogs while hospitalized. 11. Home life included nighttime difficulties, leg cramps for Dwayne, nightmares for Robert. 12. We both were able to return to school. Robert mid-October, Dwayne at midterm. 13. Both were then made fun of by some of our peers, as we were now different from them. 14. Dwayne's right arm was in a brace. Robert had difficulty speaking with partial facial paralysis. 15. Both of us had mothers who not only helped our recoveries in the hospital, but at home. 16. Aware of our new physical bodies, we saw life and others differently, living outside the box. State news. Ken Paxton flees home to avoid subpoenas and abortion advocates tell federal judge, by Chuck Lindell, Austin American Statesman, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 27th. Lawyers for abortion advocates said Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton fled his McKinney home Monday in an apparent attempt to avoid receiving two subpoenas to testify at a federal court hearing Tuesday in Austin. The hearing will discuss a lawsuit by 8 nonprofits that help pregnant Texans arrange and pay for abortions and an abortion doctor who are seeking protection against state laws that could bring heavy fines and jail time. According to an affidavit filed Monday morning, a process server was met at the door by Paxton's wife, Republican State Senator Angela Paxton, who said Paxton was unavailable. While the process server waited outside, A black SUV pulled up to the driveway. Ken Paxton walked to the car, but turned around and ran back into his garage when the server called out his name, according to the affidavit, which was first reported by the Texas Tribune. A short time later, Angela Paxton got into a second vehicle, leaving the rear door open and starting its engine, after which Ken Paxton ran from the house to the truck. I approached the truck and loudly called him by his name and stated that I had court documents for him. Mr. Paxton ignored me and kept heading for the truck, process server Ernesto Martin Herrera said in the affidavit. I stated that I was serving him with legal documents and was leaving him on the ground where he could get them. Paxton, who is seeking his third term in a November 8th election, did not pick up the documents, and both vehicles left, the affidavit said, adding, service was completed at 9:50 a.m. Responding to the Texas Tribune story about the incident, Paxton tweeted, this is a ridiculous waste of time, and the media should be ashamed of themselves. All across the country, conservatives have faced threats to their safety, many threats that received scant coverage or condemnation from the mainstream media. He continued in a second tweet, it's clear that the media wants to drum up another controversy involving my work as attorney general, so they're attacking me for having the audacity to avoid a stranger lingering outside my home and showing concern about the safety and well-being of my family. According to the affidavit, the process server identified himself to Angela Paxton and handed over his business card at the front door. Paxton's Democratic opponent, Rochelle Garza, pounced on the development, tweeting Tuesday morning, Texans deserve an AG who will uphold the law, not run from it. Oil and gas investments continue in Permian Basin, despite prices sliding to year low. By Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Current Argus, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 27th. Investors are looking to the Permian Basin to drive up revenue for stockholders, with a Houston-based investment firm announcing plans to provide $14 million in equity to develop assets in the western Delaware sub-basin of the Permian, which straddles the New Mexico-Texas border. Silverstone Energy Partners announced the funding for acquiring properties in the region by Denver-based Ocean Oil Corporation, as the company hoped to capitalize on growth in the basin. The properties recently saw 39 horizontal wells drilled. Brooke O'Neill, Ocean Chief Executive Officer, said the transaction will allow the company to continue its strategy of investing in the Permian Basin. We've established a reputation of consistently closing acquisitions or farm-ins of non-op, unconventional properties to help owners avoid the capital disruption of their own internal project needs, O'Neill said. Silverstone has expanded our capabilities even further. Silverstone Managing Director Marshall Lynn Bass said the assets were likely to prove profitable quickly in the prolific fossil fuel region and increase oil and gas production. We benefit from the resultant boost in production while the seller is able to redirect their capital expenditure dollars to other projects, Bass said. This acquisition was on the smaller side of our capabilities, but has huge strategic value to Brooke and her team. We stand ready to help them with similar transactions. As production remains strong in the region, the need for transporting and processing fossil fuels continued to grow. A pipeline sending Permian Basin natural gas to the Gulf Coast for processing and sale was being augmented to send more gas to a liquefaction facility to separate it into liquid products. The 450-mile Whistler pipeline sends gas from a hub in Waha, Texas, amid the Permian oil and gas fields, to Agua Dulce in southern Texas. An additional 43 miles of pipeline was set to be added to the line to a liquefaction facility owned by Cheniere Energy in Corpus Christi. The new line will be able to transport about 1.7 billion cubic feet per day and could later be expanded to a capacity of 2.5 BCFD. It was expected to go into service in 2024. Permian Basin operations produce the most crude of any other major U.S. shale region, with about 5.3 million barrels a day forecast for September and 5.4 million barrels for October, per the Federal Energy Information Administration's Drilling Productivity Report, released September 12th. That's more than four times the next highest producer, as the Eagle Ford Basin in southern Texas had about 1.2 million barrels of oil a day this month and was predicted to rise to about 1.3 million barrels next month, per the EIA. The Permian was the second highest producer of natural gas in the U.S., per the report, with about 20.6 billion cubic feet a day in September. The EIA report expected to rise to 20.7 billion cubic feet per day in October. The U.S.'s top gas-producing shale region was Appalachia, with about 35.5 billion cubic feet per day in September and 35.6 billion cubic feet per day forecasted for October, records show. The price of oil tumbled to one of the lowest points of the year at about $76 a barrel, reported Monday by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Despite the lower oil price this week, more oil and gas rigs were added to the Permian Basin, with New Mexico adding three rigs for a total of 111, per the latest report from Baker Hughes on Friday, an increase of 27 rigs from a total of 84 last year. Texas dropped two rigs for its total of 362 rigs, Baker Hughes reported, up 120 rigs in the last year. The Permian Basin as a whole added a rig for a total of 344, records show, up by 84 from a total of 260 on the same date last year. The EIA pointed to a resurgence of COVID-19 across the world, including in China, as a driving factor for reduced fuel demand and the value of American oil, per a September 21st report. The resurgence of COVID-19 cases since March 2022 and China's policy of localized mobility restrictions have recently reduced refinery activity in China, the report read. China's refineries have been processing less crude oil so far this year than last year, and China has also been importing less crude oil. Other global factors impacting oil prices, per the EIA, were production cuts agreed to by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, risks of hurricanes that could impact exportation from the Gulf Coast, and potential armed conflicts following a breakout in violence in the Libyan capital of Tripoli. But the EIA predicted prices to remain at or near the averages from last month, when domestic oil traded at about $90 a barrel. We estimate that crude oil prices will generally remain near August average levels through the end of 2023, per the EIA's report. What's on the line for Abbott and O'Rourke in Friday's debate? By Nikki Griswold, Austin American Statesman, published in the San Angelo Standard-Times, September 26th. Governor Greg Abbott and Democratic rival Beto O'Rourke are set to go head-to-head in their first and most likely only in-person debate Friday evening in Edinburgh, scarcely more than 5 weeks before Election Day. The highly anticipated matchup, hosted by the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley and aired by Nexstar Media Group, poses potential risks and rewards for both candidates, an opportunity to trade barbs face-to-face after months of launching attacks on the campaign trail and through political ads. Based on recent polling, the race is headed for the closest margin a Texas gubernatorial election has seen in more than 20 years. But with Abbott consistently leading O'Rourke by 5 or more percentage points in multiple polls, the debate carries very different stakes for the two candidates. Abbott has the most to lose, given that the status quo is, if nothing changes, he wins, said Mark Jones, political science fellow at Rice University. For Beto, the debate is extremely important because it gives him the opportunity to perhaps shift the dynamic of the campaign or force Abbott to do or say something that he later regrets. But even if one candidate scores points or blunders, will voters notice? The debate takes place when many Texans will be sitting in the stands of their local high school's football stadium. Abbott bets on the border. For Abbott, Jones said the strategy will be to maintain his steady lead. If the status quo doesn't change between now and November 8th, I think we're looking at an Abbott victory, with the principal doubts revolving around what the margin of victory would be, Jones said. The fact that the polling has been pretty consistent suggests that the Abbott team feels pretty comfortable where they are. Obviously, a 10-point lead is better than a 5-point lead, but I think they're pretty happy with the fact that this has been stable, said Brandon Rottinghouse, a University of Houston political science professor. In a state where Democrats have not won a statewide election in decades, Abbott is considered to hold a significant advantage in his bid to win a third term in the governor's mansion. Abbott is further bolstered by his war chest of more than $45.7 million, based on the most recent campaign finance report covering February to June of this year, which has funded 4 statewide TV ads and 2 Spanish language ads. According to an analysis by the election forecasting site 538, Abbott is clearly favored to win the race. Out of 100 possible outcomes or scenarios the analysis simulated, Abbott won 94 out of 100. Abbott has catered his campaign messaging to his Republican base, focusing on the issues that are most popular among Republican voters, especially highlighting his efforts to address border security and the influx of minors on the Texas-Mexico border. Border security issues poll well in the state, Rodinghouse said, adding that he was surprised that busing of migrants to other states polls fairly well. It's not overwhelming, but you've got a majority of Texans who approve, and so that's a winning issue for Abbott. Abbott's key focus during the debate will likely to be to double down on his main talking points and avoid making any egregious mistakes that could hurt him among Republican-based voters, Jones said. But he will also have the opportunity to go on the offensive by grouping O'Rourke with national Democrats, including President Joe Biden. Typically in midterm elections, the incumbent party in the White House doesn't fare well, Jones said, and Abbott's goal will be to harness Texans' frustration with the Biden administration and direct it toward Beto. It's far too easy for Abbott and the Abbott campaign to now tie O'Rourke to the Biden administration because during 2018, Beto did not run as a national Democrat. He ran as sort of a unique Texas Democrat. Whereas after in 2020, when he ran for the Democratic presidential nomination, he ran as a national Democrat, and that's the image that has remained with him, Jones said. When Beto ran for Senate, he just skated on a skateboard, Abbott told the U.S. Today Network on Tuesday. When he ran for president the first time, he really took policy positions, and they were part of the leftist progressive agenda that repel people in Texas. The values that he has stood for are not Texas values. I will make that clear during the debate. O'Rourke focuses on gun access and abortion. For O'Rourke, the debate presents a critical opportunity to score points against Abbott. I think his strategy is to probably go on the emotional angle to try to provoke Abbott into some type of response that can be used against him later on, Jones said. There'll be amplified media coverage if something occurs. So I think if you're Beto, you're trying to paint Abbott into a corner, get him to say or do something that he would later regret. O'Rourke will seek to attack Abbott's record with a particular focus on his stances on gun access and abortion, given the mass shooting in Uvalde and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to end constitutional protections for abortion. Both seismic events have had a mass mobilizing effect among Democrats nationally, giving the Democratic Party more optimism that the midterms might not bring the red wave that pundits had been forecasting. And with both issues particularly relevant in Texas, they've been core parts of O'Rourke's campaign strategy. Abbott has signed several bills over multiple sessions loosening gun restrictions, including legislation last year that ended the requirement to obtain a permit to carry a gun. And this year, he has refused to call a special session to address gun safety and has called unconstitutional raising the minimum wage age to purchase an assault-style rifle, while acknowledging that it's something that Uvalde families are pushing for. On abortion, he signed a near-total ban on the procedure, which took effect this summer. He's in a weak spot in that he wholeheartedly opposed gun control legislation, and he supported the trigger law, Jones said, referring to the abortion ban. He can waffle a little bit on it, but by and large, he owns those policies, his policies on gun control and abortion, which are in the minority now. For abortion, it's only in the minority because they didn't include a rape and incest exception. If they had done that, he'd be pretty close to the majority, but they did. Based on recent polling, Abbott isn't aligned with the majority of Texans on those issues. According to the most recent poll from the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas, a large majority of Texas voters support at least some access to abortion, especially in case of rape or incest. The only exception in the Texas ban is when the life of the pregnant person is in jeopardy. A majority of Texas voters also indicate they support some gun restrictions, including raising the minimum age to purchase assault-style rifles from 18 to 21. As he has on the campaign trail, O'Rourke is likely to focus on those positions. One thing for sure, O'Rourke is going to talk about the impact of gun violence, and he will definitely bring these very emotional examples. And if Greg Abbott cannot show the emotions that parents and communities feel when they sort of get to these issues, I think it might make him look too robotic, Rodinghouse said. Any particularly fiery moments in the debate would also provide fodder for O'Rourke in TV and social media ads. Beto needs to pull out all the stops and do everything he can to get earned media coverage, to connect with voters, to try to mobilize people who otherwise wouldn't turn out to vote, Jones said. Appealing to moderates and independents. From February to the end of June, O'Rourke raised a record-breaking $27.6 million, the most any candidate for statewide office in Texas has ever raised in a single reporting period. Those dollars have funded three TV ads that have aired statewide and one Spanish ad. Several videos in O'Rourke's robust social media campaign feature Republican voters who attest that despite their previous voting record, they would be voting for O'Rourke in this election after seeing the Democrat on his recently concluded marathon 49-day campaign tour across the state. O'Rourke appeared at more than 70 town hall-style events in more than 65 counties, marketed as a grassroots campaign for all Texans. Rodinghouse says O'Rourke's main challenge moving forward will be to peel off any undecided, moderate, or independent voters who might be dissatisfied with the direction of the Republican Party in Texas and try to convince them Abbott is undeserving of a third term in office. Swaying reluctant Republicans, moderates, and independent-leaning conservatives is job one for Beto O'Rourke, Rodinghouse said. Democrats are going to come out in big numbers for him. We're seeing big rallies the way we saw in 18 and 20. So he's going to get those Democrats to come out. But if he's going to win, he's got to take a bite out of Abbott's natural advantage among the Republican base. But for O'Rourke, that's a tall ask in a race that has become a battle of the bases. The biggest challenge for both sides is that this is a very polarized race, where partisans are already committed to their candidate and there are a few undecideds. There's not a lot of wiggle room for persuasion, Rodinghouse said. So I think we will spend a lot of time on base mobilization, and O'Rourke will spend time and money trying to specifically target people who will potentially leave the Republican ticket or leave the Republican base temporarily. We want to use the hour of the debate to prosecute the case against Greg Abbott and make it very clear for voters why he should not have four more years, said O'Rourke campaign spokesman Chris Evans. Whether it's the six major mass shootings to happen on his watch since he took office, whether it's rising crime since he took office, whether it's the grid failing and 700 people dying, whether it's property taxes going up 40% since he took office, on any given issue, we're going to be able to talk about how Greg Abbott has failed Texas and point out how Beto is also able to offer a better path forward. Could this debate move the needle? While the debate does provide a chance for both candidates to land some punches, Jones is doubtful that the debate will have an impact on undecided voters and the election's outcome. The only time debates move the needle is if one of the candidates makes an egregious error. But by and large, most debates pass unnoticed, said Jones. Scheduled to begin at 7 p.m. September 30th, the debate will be competing for voters' attention during Friday night football and other end-of-the-week work week social activities. Though O'Rourke has proposed an additional four town hall style debates, Abbott has not yet agreed to that idea, with his campaign implying that Friday's debate is the only one he is willing to attend. Early voting starts October 24th. Election day is November 8th. Texas Tech fined $50,000 by Big 12, Sikh fan who pushed UT player after Saturday's game, by Adam D. Young, Lubbock Avalanche Journal, published in the San Angelo Standard-Times, September 27th. Texas Tech is being fined $50,000 by the Big 12 Conference for the field storming incident that came after the Red Raiders' win over number 22 Texas, while Tech Athletics and the university's police department continue searching for a fan who shoved a UT athlete during the mayhem. Texas Tech head football coach Joey McGuire also weighed in on the behavior, saying during a Monday media availability that he's hopeful Red Raider fans follow the lead of good sportsmanship and behavior that he strives to instill in his players. On Monday, the Big 12 Conference issued a public reprimand and a $50,000 fine of Texas Tech for the field storming incident that occurred at the conclusion of Tech's 37-34 overtime win over UT at Jones AT&T Stadium in Lubbock. "We have a duty to provide a safe game environment," Big 12 Conference Commissioner Brett Yormark said in a statement. "The Texas Tech Department of Athletics has a written event management policy that, while well thought out, was unsuccessful in ensuring the safety and security of all visiting team student athletes, officials, coaches, and staff. There is a zero tolerance for any act that compromises the safety of game participants, and it is of utmost importance that home game management provide adequate security measures for our student athletes, coaches, game officials, and spectators." While Tech Athletics initially confirmed to the Avalanche Journal that Tech's administrative operating budget would cover the hefty fine, the athletics program later announced that Citibank, a longtime corporate partner, committed to paying the fine for the post-game celebration. "We are grateful for Citibank and their long-term support of Texas Tech Athletics," Texas Tech Athletics Director Kirby Hokut said in a release. "We have passionate fans involving our great partners at Citibank and their president, Corey Newsom." McGuire briefly addressed the incident during a regular media availability earlier Monday before the fine was announced. McGuire said he stresses the importance for his athletes to play with class. "I think every person would say that my players play with class. They play the game the way it's supposed to be played, the way they're supposed to act," McGuire said. "I hope that we continue to do that as a football program and be the class of college football. And that's what you control, what you can control. I control that because that's what I'm over. I'm going to make sure I'm pouring into my guys, get them to understand the way you're supposed to play football, and hopefully that carries over as an example for everybody." Tech Athletics released a statement early Monday evening in response to the fine and reprimand. "Texas Tech does not condone any physical altercations between spectators and student athletes," the statement reads. "This behavior has no place at Texas Tech athletic events. We're committed to providing a safe game environment and will continue to discuss opportunities to strengthen all operations." Texas Tech Athletics on Sunday released a screen grab from a video showing a fan pushing a UT football player as fans rushed the field following the game Saturday. The video, which was circulating on social media Sunday, appears to show a male fan who was amongst the crowd of Tech fans rushing the field, running and pushing a UT football player down. Tech Athletics confirmed the video was brought to their attention and condemned the violence in a social media post Sunday evening, calling for information to help identify the person. "This behavior is unacceptable, and Texas Tech Athletics has turned the matter over to the Texas Tech Police Department," reads the message from Tech Athletics. "We will work together to identify the fan and take further action. Anyone with information that can assist in identifying the attacker is urged to call the Texas Tech Police Department." Texas Bureau. Despite hell yes comment, O'Rourke acknowledges taking AR-15s is a non-starter in Texas. Beto O'Rourke says he's now focused on gun policies that have a chance or bipartisan support. By John C. Moritz and Nikki Griswold, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 24th, Austin. Democrat Beto O'Rourke acknowledged that his hell yes promise to take military assault style weapons from law-abiding citizens is a non-starter for many Texas voters as his uphill challenge to Republican Governor Greg Abbott heads into its final 6 weeks before the November 8th election. In an interview Saturday as part of a wide-ranging political symposium hosted by the Texas Tribune, O'Rourke told a packed house inside a downtown Austin theater that he still believes no one younger than 21 should be allowed to purchase such rifles as AR-15, modeled after the U.S. military's M-16 or an AK-47, the battlefield weapon of the old Soviet Union. But an outright prohibition of private ownership is unlikely ever to gain widespread acceptance in Texas, O'Rourke said. The important thing is to get something done and not to allow the perfect to become the enemy of the good, O'Rourke told interviewer Lawrence Wright, a staff writer for The New Yorker. There are many things that will argue, but on this issue of prioritizing the lives of our children, I have sought out and found that common ground among Republicans, non-gun owners, Democrats, gun owners alike, can agree on raising the age of purchase on a red flag law so we can intervene before it's too late. The question came about during an hour-long discussion about O'Rourke's campaign against Abbott, where polls show him trailing by about 5 to 9 percentage points. The issue of assault-style rifle ownership bolted to the top of the agenda after the May 24th massacre inside Uvalde Robb Elementary School, where an 18-year-old AR-15-toting gunman shot and killed 19 children and 2 teachers. Even before that, O'Rourke was calling for raising the age for legal purchase of such a rifle from 18 to 21. And before the shooting, Abbott scarcely passed up an opportunity to remind voters of O'Rourke's pledge during his brief run for president during the 2020 cycle that, hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. Abbott has not scheduled an appearance at the news organization symposium, commonly called TribFest. O'Rourke often boasts that he's been among few Democrats since the Republicans cemented their lock of Texas politics a generation ago to aggressively court votes in conservative rural and exurban pockets of the state, where many believe gun ownership is a sacred right. But he said that while government confiscation alienates millions of Texans, agreement is possible on such topics as requiring training for purchasers and limiting the ability of people who make violent threats or have been judged to be mentally unstable to legally buy weapons. In a universal background check that just simply says, if you're going to buy a gun in Texas, we're not cool with that, O'Rourke said. We just want to make sure not going to be a danger to yourself or to anyone else. These 3 steps will save lives, allow us to defend the Second Amendment, while doing a better job of protecting the lives of the people in our communities. O'Rourke's appearance followed a separate interview by Republican U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who the El Paso Democrat challenged in 2018, where gun ownership also took center stage. Cruz stoutly defended law-abiding Texans' right to own the weapons O'Rourke would seek to limit and was heckled by some in the audience who disagreed with his stance. Cruz pushed back even as some attempted to shout him down and others in the audience cheered their efforts. You can clap for that, except for the minor problem that it doesn't work, he said. When questioned by Washington Examiner senior correspondent David Drucker about what policies he would support to address the epidemic of mass shootings, Cruz advocated for legislation he's proposed that would double the number of police officers in schools, prompting one audience member to shout, "That didn't work in Uvalde." Cruz responded by calling for the audience to engage in a reasonable conversation rather than yelling, and pointed toward legislation he supports that would fund thousands of new mental health counselor positions at schools. When that lunatic got to the school in Uvalde, there wasn't a police officer on campus. He was able to get in through an open back door. He got into the classroom and was murdering kids before the police got there, Cruz said. Look, if you have a solution to stop a deranged, evil murderer, I'd love to hear it, Cruz said. My solution is to throw them in jail, stop the repeat felons, the fugitives, those with mental illness, stop them before they commit these crimes. There are some we know about before we won't know about beforehand, and the single best step to stop them is to have armed officers on campus before they kill our kids. While other Republicans are now avoiding the abortion issue, Abbott is embracing it. After the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, voters in Kansas upheld abortion rights in that state. That led many Republicans to downplay the divisive issue heading into the midterm election. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 24th, Austin. Maybe Governor Greg Abbott didn't get the memo about Republicans steering clear of the abortion issue during the 2022 election cycle in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling overturning Roe v. Wade in June and the decision by voters in conservative Kansas to uphold a woman's right in that state to terminate a pregnancy. After the Kansas vote August 2nd, a handful of GOP congressional candidates around the country quietly removed mentions of their long-standing opposition to abortion rights from their campaign websites, which Democratic groups were eager to publicize after the fact. And then in mid-September, Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina took some serious blowback from leaders in his own party after he promised to carry a bill outlawing abortion nationwide after 15 weeks of pregnancy if the GOP wins control of the Senate in November. Even U.S. Senator John Cornyn of Texas distanced himself from Graham's promise, saying his colleague was not speaking for the Republican caucus writ large. The High Court's decision in the June 24th case, known as Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, has proved something of a dog-that-caught-the-car example for Republicans, who for decades railed against the 1973 Roe decision, all the while knowing they were arguing in the abstract a message that resonated among the base voters, but not so much in the nation as a whole. Now Republicans are worried that the 2022 midterms will be a referendum on Roe. But Abbott, who is in a spirited race for a third term against Democrat Beto O'Rourke, heading toward November 8th, appears quite content to have caught the car when it comes to abortion. He's currently running digital ads calling O'Rourke an abortion extremist, because like most of the other Democrats who sought their party's 2020 presidential nomination, the former congressman from El Paso did not expressively come out in opposition to ending a pregnancy in the third trimester. This is a decision that neither you nor I nor the United States government should be making, O'Rourke was quoted as saying in response to a voter's question at the time. That's a decision for the woman to make. Hitting O'Rourke, or pretty much any candidate for any office, for not condemning third trimester abortions would not ordinarily carry much political risk, at least before the High Court's ruling. A poll by the Pew Research Center before the Dobbs decision was announced showed that about 6 in 10 Americans think abortion should be legal in most cases. But when asked specifically about late-term abortions, the approval rate shrinks closer to 3 in 10. But post-Dobbs, Abbott putting the abortion issue in play might remind voters that over the years, he has signed laws that have chipped away at abortion rights, even as many assumed that the overarching protections provided by Roe would never be rolled back. In fact, the governor championed the so-called trigger law, which in the event Roe was overturned, automatically outlawed abortion in Texas any time after conception and made no exceptions for pregnancies caused by rape or incest. The Texas law is among the nation's strictest. A poll released Thursday, conducted by Spectrum News and New York's Siena College Research Institute, found that support for abortion rights is stronger in Texas than in the nation as a whole. The poll of 651 self-identified likely voters, taken by telephone September 14th through the 18th, found that 64% oppose outlawing abortion under the parameters of existing state laws. But the same poll suggests that Abbott's enthusiasm for restricting abortion is not hurting him with the sizable block of voters who do not share his views on the issue. Put simply, Abbott's opposition to abortion is not a deal-breaker for that block. His lead over O'Rourke is 7 percentage points, with a 4.4 percentage point margin of error, and is consistent with other recent polling. For his part, O'Rourke seldom passes up an opportunity to remind voters of Abbott's abortion track record. The Democrats' first two TV ads of the campaign were devoted entirely to that topic, and O'Rourke's campaign is scouring all pockets, looking for otherwise apathetic Texans who might now be motivated to help win back the right that they held, and perhaps had taken for granted, for 49 years. By calling attention to the abortion issue on his own, Abbott appears to be responding, "Bring it." And now sports. San Angelo Central beats Wiley 63-61 on last second TD pass by Charles Bryce, published September 25th. San Angelo Central High School quarterback Tyler Hill connected with Ben Eimler on a Hail Mary touchdown pass as time expired to life the Bobcats over Wiley 63-61 on homecoming Friday night at San Angelo Stadium. Hill was 18 of 26 passing for 279 yards and three TDs against one interception. He had 23 carries for a career high, 263 yards and four TDs. Eimler led the Bobcats receiving corps with six receptions for 119 yards and three TDs. Wiley quarterback KJ Long also had an outstanding game with four touchdown passes. Central improved to 3-2, while Wiley dropped to 2-3 with its third straight narrow loss. The Bulldogs have lost those three games by a combined 14 points. This was the first meeting between the 6A Bobcats and 5A Bulldogs on the gridiron and the first game for Wiley against a 6A school. The Bobcats were up 49-48 early in the fourth quarter before Wiley answered with a 5-yard touchdown pass from Long to wide receiver Harrison Heighton that made it 54-49 Bulldogs with 4:57 left. Central regained the lead after a 13-yard TD run by Hill, followed by a 2-point conversion pass from Hill to Tyler Walker that made it 57-54 Bobcats with 1:25 left. The back-and-forth battle continued as the Bulldogs went up 61-57 on a 14-yard TD run by Long with 19 seconds remaining. A long kickoff return by Central's Kevin Rice gave the Bobcats a good field position at the Wiley 48, and two plays later, Hill connected with Eimler for the game winner. Hill first had to somehow shake off a tackle by a Wiley defensive lineman before he rolled to his right and delivered a strike to Eimler, who caught it at the 10 and cut back across the field, getting a block by Rice as he ran into the end zone and was mobbed by his teammates. "I'm certainly proud of them for the way they hung in there and continued to fight," Central head coach Kevin Crane said. "It would have been real easy to give up there at the end. Kevin getting a big kickoff return. That was a huge part of the deal, too, because if we don't have that good field position right there, we're not going to get that score. We had a little desperation play, and we threw it to Ben Eimler, and Eimler pitched it back to Tyler Walker, and we were able to call a timeout. And then we had a Hail Mary, and Tyler was able to break away and have enough on the ball to get it down as far as he did. We had some good blocks down there as well to make sure we got in." Central led 35-28 at the half. The Bobcats stretched their advantage to 42-28 on a 37-yard TD pass from Hill to Eimler at the 9:58 mark of the third. Wiley pulled within 42-35 on the ensuing possession as Long hooked up with Braden Regala for a 32-yard TD strike with 7:38 left in the third. Central went up by two TDs again later in the third, as Tyree Brawley scored on a 1-yard run at the 3:47 mark. The Bulldogs had a lot of fight still in them, though. Long threw a 63-yard TD pass to Regala to get Wiley within 49-42 with 2:38 left in the third. The Bulldogs got within 49-48 on a 35-yard TD run by Landry Carlton with 10:02 remaining in the fourth. The conversion kick failed. On Central's next series, Hill was picked off by Hayden Wright, and the Bulldogs took over at the Bobcats' 30-yard line with 7:21 left. A 53-yard run by the Wiley QB on 3rd and 4 from the Central 36 gave the Bulldogs a first down at the Central 11. Long then threw a 5-yard TD pass to Heighton to give Wiley a 54-49 lead with 4:57 left after the pat pass failed. Central regained the lead on a 13-yard TD run by Hill and a pat pass from Hill to Walker, making it 57-54 Bobcats with 1:25 left. The Bobcats know how fortunate they were to pull this thing and give themselves a 2-game winning streak heading into district. "Wiley's a really good football team, and we knew that," the Central coach said. "They scared the dog out of me. They're a traditional powerhouse, and they've played in state championship games. They were huge on their offensive line, almost 6'5" across the board. And the quarterback, I can't say enough good things about him. That guy was hard to get a hold of. He was able to scramble and make some plays with his legs. And when he had time, he was putting that ball on the money, too, in the passing game." Wiley is off next week before opening 2-5-A play at home against Plainview on October 2nd. Lakeview football team gets shut out on the road against Leveland by Charles Bryce, published September 25th. Lakeview High School football team dropped a 17-0 decision on the road against Leveland in a non-district game Friday night. Leveland improved to 1-4, while Lakeview dropped to 3-2. Leveland built a 14-0 cushion in the first quarter and added a field goal in the fourth. Lakeview, which has been hobbled by injuries, was held to 59 yards total offense. Leveland finished with 239 yards. The Chiefs will try to bounce back with the win in their non-district finale against Greenwood at 7 p.m. Friday, September 30th at San Angelo Stadium. Lakeview will open District 2-4A play on the road against Andrews on Friday, October 7th. Number 4 Angelo State football team knocks off number 22 West Texas A&M by Charles Bryce, published September 25th. After a slow start in the first half, number 4 Angelo State University got into a groove and rolled to a convincing 34-14 blowout against number 22 West Texas A&M in a Lone Star Conference football showdown at First Community Credit Union Field at LeGrand Stadium on Saturday night. ASU improved to 4-0 overall and 2-0 in the LSC, while dropping WT to 2-2 and 0-2. The Rams snapped a two-game losing streak against the Buffaloes. This is the fourth time that ASU has started 4-0. The last three times were in 2005, 2014, and 2019. WT led 7-6 at the half, courtesy of a 25-yard touchdown run by quarterback Nick Gerber in the second quarter. ASU was held to a pair of field goals by Asa Fuller in the first half. The Rams scored two straight TDs in the third quarter to take a 20-7 advantage in the final period. ASU quarterback Zach Bronckhorst hooked up with wide receiver Kyle Bradford for a 7-yard TD loss in the third, followed by a 2-yard TD run by running back Nate Amoriabu. The Buffs cut the deficit to 20-14 early in the fourth on a 2-yard TD run by Shaquille Brown. The Rams finished things off with a 21-yard TD run by Kaysen Phillips in the fourth, followed by a spectacular 89-yard pick six by cornerback Andrew Pitts. "He's electric in what he does," Gersh said of Pitts, who had his first pick six of the season last week against UT Permian Basin. "He's a chance taker, sometimes, and a risk taker, but just an unbelievable football player. He's a punt return guy. He goes and picks up footballs that probably shouldn't be picked up at times, but I want him to be Andrew because he's a true game breaker. When the ball gets in his hands, he's dangerous." Omabu had 19 carries for 97 yards and one TD. "The first thing that he'll talk about is him putting the ball on the ground and fumbling," Gersh said of the defending LSC rushing champion. "That's the thing that's bothering him, and that's what I love about that kid. He's a fierce competitor, and Nate's Nate. He's going to be great for us every single night. We've got to open some holes and let him run through them." "I was really proud of our tight ends, too. We had a couple of injuries with the two starting tight ends, so we played guys who were basically third and fourth on our depth chart, Bo Workman and Drew Karstens. I don't think they had a catch tonight, but they did an unbelievable job blocking and running and opening those holes, just like the O-line did." Bronckhorst completed 27 of 39 passes for 279 yards and one TD. He was picked off once. Rasheen Green led the Rams receiving core with 5 receptions for 67 yards, and Noah Massey had for 56. Phillips, 42 yards, and Bradford, 40 yards, also caught 5 passes. Former San Angelo Central High School receiver Thomas Eich, who is now in graduate school, snagged 3 passes for 27 yards. Gerber was held to 14 of 24 passing for 189 yards. "Nick's an absolute stud football player," Gersh said. "I've really enjoyed competing against him, and I've told him that after the game. I love watching that kid play, as long as he doesn't play against us very much. Our defense did a great job of keeping him under wraps. He hurt us on a couple of scrambles. He's a fierce competitor, and I'm proud of the way our guys battled through it to keep him from doing too much. The Rams had the home field advantage on this night. We love our fans, Gurr said. Winning's fun, and fans love to come and watch teams win, and we're doing that right now. We've got to keep it rolling. It was just an awesome atmosphere. WT is a top-notch program and a top-notch institution, and we know that. They bring a lot of fans. It's a rivalry, but it's a really good rivalry in the sense that the guys play hard against each other and they respect each other. The staffs respect each other. It's always a good game when we play them, and it's always fun to beat them. Fans were treated to a fireworks show afterwards. ASU will look to remain undefeated when the Rams travel to Western Oregon next Saturday for the first LSC matchup between the two programs. We'll head out to Western Oregon on Friday, and we'll see how it is on the West Coast, Gersh said. Western Oregon dropped to 1-3 overall and 0-2 in the LSC after a 27-24 setback at home against UTPB on Saturday. Now here's the column by Allison Watkins. Consider adding a Texas superstar plant to your garden this year. Published September 22nd. Gardening is the number one hobby in the United States, whether it be growing food in a vegetable garden or keeping up beautiful curb appeal. Caring for plants is a wonderful way to connect with nature, get outside for fresh air and sunshine, and enjoy a whole host of mental and physical health benefits. Gardening is tough in West Texas, though. It was a very discouraging year, and many plants are still stressed from the long, dry heat. There are lots of tips and tricks to help keeping plants alive easier without wasting water, such as preparing the soil well with compost, using drip irrigation, applying thick wood mulch, etc. But one of the most important steps is to start with good plant selection. Choose plants that are native or well adapted to the soil and environmental conditions of the Concho Valley. This will help plants stay healthier while reducing maintenance. One resource to help with good plant selection is the list of Texas superstar plants promoted by Texas A&M University. https://texassuperstar.com. These plants have been tested through the state, perform well, and are generally available at most nurseries and garden centers. The newest plant to earn the Texas Superstar designation is the holly fern. Holly fern has thick, glossy leaves that appear similar to holly shrubs and makes a nice specimen plant, background, or border. It prefers part shade but can handle full shade. Morning sun and afternoon shade is an ideal sight. Also announced in 2022 to receive the designation were red yucca and tangerine beauty crossvine. Red yucca is a staple landscape plant in West Texas and is very tough and hardy once established. The native variety has flowers that are more of a pink shade, but there are cultivated varieties available in an assortment of shades, from dark red, brake lights, to yellow. Tangerine Beauty Crossvine is a spring-blooming evergreen vine that boasts a profusion of flowers that look like an orange waterfall in the spring. Other Texas superstar plants that are favorites for the Concho Valley include annuals like fall zinnias, pentas, gomphrena, whopper begonia, perennials such as new gold lantana, mystic spires, blue salvia, and shrubs, Lynn's Legacy Senzio, blue angel althea. There are even fruit, vegetable, and herb varieties that are Texas superstars, such as the balsamic blooms basil, Victoria Red Grape, Natchez Blackberry, Green Magic Broccoli, and Arctic Frost Satsuma. Fall is the best time to plant trees, shrubs, perennials, ground covers, cool season annuals, wildflower seeds, and spring bulbs. For best results, try to find the ones that will thrive in the challenging climate of West Texas. Another good resource is the Earth Kind Plant Selector, https://eks.tamu.edu. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.